C1A. Number 16A.
What we are really considering with the textbook is that science and health give us the principle of science. It interprets the principle of the signs of God. And so each chapter within that textbook really presents us the principle of that chapter. That is, we saw the chapter on prayer, and what we were investigating was the principle of prayer, or the science of prayer. And with the second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, we are considering the principle of Atonement and Eucharist, or the science of Atonement and Eucharist. Just finding out, really, that there are not many principles of prayer and not many principles of Atonement, that there is just one principle of prayer, which naturally is coming to each one of us in an individual way, but always as one principle. And so acquainting ourselves, for instance, with the principle of prayer, we can no more misuse prayer. I think that's a very important and nice point, that we see that if we know the principle of prayer, we can no more pray wrong. We can no more misuse that wonderful thing which says, I have an access to God. And so we find the divinely principled access to God. And in the same way, we can see that, you remember perhaps how we laid the stress on that point in prayer, that prayer really doesn't give us an indication for what we should pray. I don't think that's right. Sometimes I say things because I can't express myself quickly enough. We saw there that prayer doesn't show us that we have different prayers for different purposes. It doesn't give, as in many religions, a sort of prayer if you want to heal or if you need another job or if something goes wrong in the family and in, with the cattle and with the cow and so on. You know all that? No, it shows the principle of prayer. And if we stick to the principle of prayer, we can no more misuse prayer. And what is the use of prayer? And we see now that the use of prayer is Atonement and Eucharist. The immediate use, I would say, of prayer is Atonement and Eucharist. So we pray really for one purpose, namely to atone with God and to disatone or disunify ourselves with whatever is of a false covenant. So in that sense of the way of life, of finding our true manhood, of working out the birth of our true spiritual manhood, we really can see that the immediate purpose of prayer is atoning with God. That's really our demonstration, our one and thing and foremost demonstration, to atone with God. And in atoning with God, we have the Eucharist of laying down false bondage, a false unit with anything except which is besides God. Also, I feel we must always keep in mind the connection between these two chapters. To see that Atonement and Eucharist, which in one or the other way always knocks at our door in life, that practically every day something happens of the nature which, of Atonement and Eucharist knocking at our door, and we feel we have to face atoning, and we have faced the willingness of laying down something, and we have to see that if that knocks at our door, that we go back to prayer first, that we find, so to say, our strength and our values and the substance of solving something in Atonement and Eucharist, that we find that in the chapter on prayer. That chapter on prayer really first gives us the equipment, so to say, in order to tackle afterwards in Atonement and Eucharist the problem. I say that because if we try to start with Atonement and Eucharist, we can't do it in a divine way. We would do it in a moral way or in a religious way or in a way of human will. To will something, to will to atone with God, to will to be one with God, to will to reject error, we would will it. Whereas the gentle way, the scientific way, shows that it must be the divine qualities in us, the divine fact in us, which we have gathered in the chapter on prayer, which has that power, that Christ power, which is able to out whatever is wrong in us. So we see that prayer, the principle of prayer, gives us a sense of the divine qualities, the kingdom of heaven within us, which is already one with God. And it says, I commune within that kingdom of God for the one purpose, to work out divine ways, the divine purpose of being, and I work it out by laying down the human sense of it. The divine must overcome the human at every point. That's one of the main tones, the main tune running through that second chapter. Now, yesterday we went through the first five big subjects, and for those who haven't been here, I just want to recapitulate quickly and to see the order in it. So the first subject of Atonement and Eucharist is presenting mind which furthers on, which impels us and furthers on to work towards an atonement with the divine, to work towards a covenant with the divine mind, asking us to lay down, to leave behind the human will and the human effort and all that. Now, in order to reach this goal, in order to comply with the demand of mind to be one with the divine mind, the second subject comes in and says, in order to comply with that and exemplify that, you have to turn away from a false covenant, from the false covenant with your human mind, false covenant with your material sense, false covenant with the testimony of the physical sense, and so on. You have to turn away and constantly look towards the imperishable things of spirit. In doing that, in turning away from the other God and turning to the one God, thou shalt have but one God before me. In doing that, we see that this implies the third state, namely that we must do that constantly, that in turning away from the false God and in turning towards the one God, there is the need of doing it persistently, without wavering, consistently, without swerving, and work in that direct line without looking back. Occupy till I come. So we can see how naturally the third evolves out of the second. But if we wouldn't have the first and the second, we wouldn't know in which direction we should be perseverant and unswerving. But the first and second subject, as you see, have first given us the command in mind, then in spirit it has given direction to this command, turning away from material sense, turning towards the spiritual. Having given the direction, then we know that we have to keep to that direction, stick to that direction, be enduring in that direction, be constant, firm in that direction. That's the third. Then we know in what to be firm. And so, in having found the direct line in which we have to persevere, we really can ask ourselves then, all right, and now what does this imply? What is now the big implication of this way of mind, spirit, soul? And so we come to the governing principle, to the governing system of atonement, in which we have seen in the fourth subject really the scientific constituents of atonement in which we have to persevere, you see. And we have seen there that it is uncovering the powerlessness of a theological sense of atonement. That in us we have to lay down a purely theological and even psychological and a spiritualistic interpretation of the biblical sense of atonement. and to cling to and persevere in a scientific system of atonement. And we have seen what that what the constituents of it are. Having seen that science interprets a divine system of atoning, giving the seven main constituents of what atonement consists of, and showing that obedience and compliance with that principle gives us power, gives us demonstrative power, gives us spiritual power. And we have seen that it says it gives power for what? And it culminated in principle of love in showing that this power is given us not for a personal sense or for a personal aim or for a personal purpose, but for a principal purpose, namely shows to prove that the divine principle is God, that God really is the power in the messianic work. And so that really our whole demonstration is, if it is pure, then it is not demonstrating something personal or material or human or egotistic. It is, if our demonstration is pure, it just demonstrates God, that God is the power in the messianic work. That's the purity of a demonstration, which shows itself in what we humanly call a demonstration. But that isn't the main point, what humanly it is, how humanly it presents itself. The main point is always what is in the motive of the petitioner, in the motive and the aim of our demonstration. If that motive and aim is it God, to prove God, or is it to have a personal advantage of it? Having shown that purity and holiness really of demonstration, which empowers our unity with Prince, and having shown that it is to demonstrate the plan of God and not the plan of man, then we have seen how then the subject was ready to go over to the throne of life and say, but what does God really demonstrate? What is it really that God demonstrates? And God demonstrates nothing else but life, which has an outflow as truth and which shows its plan in love. So immediately he goes on to the throne of life and says, yes, what Jesus proved through his statement was really but one thing, that life is God. That life is God. And so we came to that fifth big subject where it was shown that atonement demands that divine sense of life. It urges us to get the divine sense of life and not the human sense of life and not the material sense of life and not an improved sense of human and material life. But that atonement comes and says, atone yourself with that what principle always demonstrates, namely to demonstrate itself as being, as life, which means a Eucharist, which means to lay down a misconception of life, that misapprehension of life, which has been presented as that misapprehension that life is destructive, that life is mingling with sin, matter, and death, that life is something haphazard, that it isn't definite in spiritual understanding, that life is that what the world thinks life may be, that life is that which the world measures to be life, and so on. Says, no, let that go. Atonement demands but one atoning, but one at one moment, but one unity, and that's the unity but with one life, namely God. Proof that life is what? God says, and not the world's sense of life. Meaning that we must be willing to give up the age-old belief of life in matter. That's the crux of every in life. To give up the belief of life in matter. And we have seen what a freedom and what an enormous liberation comes into our whole life and existence and being if we are honest to our conviction and are honest to our words and our statements that God is life and stick to it and persevere in it and accept it for what it is, and that we don't fall back at every other moment where we weep and wail about life in matter. Now, if we come inwardly, really inwardly, not just by statements, not just by saying things, but inwardly to that inward conviction, we certainly only come to that by constant sacrifice, by constant work, by constantly tackling these problems and these suggestions, and tackling them time and time again until something grows stronger and stronger in us and becomes a present fact, a conscious present fact. If we arrive at that point where we begin to see that principle only demonstrates life, and that principle can't demonstrate anything but life which is God, and that there is no other life but that life which is God, and that everything which the human terms life has never lived, the world can say, and the human sense can say, that something lives and lives. If it isn't of God, it has never lived. No matter how often we say it lives, and it does live, it never lives. Only that lives which is of God, that which is the demonstration of principle. Now, if we begin to see that only that lives which comes from God, then we find the connection to truth. Then the point comes where we say, well, what does come from God's life? What does come from that eternal Father? What does come from that eternal fatherhood? What is the creation of God's life? And we come to his creation, to the Son, to truth, symbolized by truth. To that which God creates is true. That which is life alone is true. And so we come to truth. And at that very moment, you see, Mrs. Eddy starts with the sixth subject and depicts really the form of the creation of the fatherhood, the Son, and depicts the true man, the true Son of that Father life. And that true Son is depicted here as the birth of the true man, which is spiritual, eternal, perfect, glorified. And so what we witness in this sixth subject is the birth in our consciousness, the springing to being in our consciousness, I say in our consciousness, of what the true man, what constitutes the true man. Here, always we have seen that lies in the whole structure of the 7 days of faith, that the moment we come to truth, something changes, something radically changes. We always come to the solution. And so in this sixth subject, we don't get any more that strong sense of a demand of the Christ as we had it in the first five subjects. The first five subjects was always that atonement demands something from us, namely always the laying down of the false sense of mind, the false sense of spirit, the false sense of soul, the false sense of principle, the false sense of life. And in truth, we always get the effect of it. And here it is shown really not so much a demand of truth, but showing that if we fulfill the first five demands, that gives us a new man. And so here what it is showing is that this atonement through the first five subjects, that this atoning with God brings to birth man at one man with God. What we have now is no more so much the atoning as the much more the revelation of that which is at one man with God. Perhaps you have noticed in the text that whenever he uses the term at one man, it is either in the subtone of truth or in the main tone of truth. There is no chance about that. She couldn't do it otherwise, or she would have tried to dilute, or to not to dilute. It wouldn't be in the order of the thing. See, because in the line of the days of creation, we only come in truth at one man. The 5 days are here to work out the laying down of the false concept of man, so that in the 6 day we have the true man. That in the 6 day the true man appears in the at-one-ment of God. Well, you may have a quiet time about that, but here, you see, we get now that wonderful touch of man being really at one with God. And the illustration she gives through this rather long tone, about 6.5 pages or so, is to give now what I would say a chronological, a divinely chronological history of Jesus as the Christ. Up to now, he used all sorts of symbolism from the Bible and from Jesus' life to illustrate the divine fact. And he took those illustrations quite out of a chronological sequence or order. All that was ordered was the spiritual import. That was ordered. That was ordered according to the days of creation. But now, when he comes to the birth of man, he shows that this was exemplified wholly and consistently in Jesus' life. That Jesus' life from conception to ascension, and even further on to us, to his import of his Christ career on the world up to now, to the Christian scientists, that this is, shows that in a chronological order, because it's the birth of manhood. It's that birth of manhood which we all witness. And so here we may find Jesus exemplifying in a chronological sequence the birth of man. She starts right in by saying that the disciples of Jesus believed him to be the Son of God. You see, at once you get a change of tone. You come now to the Son of God. That's the first time he speaks about that. The side note is the fatherhood of God, because there is no Son of God without fatherhood of God. Oh, if we only would stick to a sequence. We try to demonstrate man without first, the second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth day. And we can't. We can't. And the first chapter in the Bible tells us that we can't. That man is a state of consciousness which only springs into fullness of life when consciousness has been broadened out through the first 5 days of creation. And so if we want to have manhood, we just can't start with manhood. It's a birth that's going on through the first 5 days, the first 5 days. Here it is shown that the fatherhood of God is really the source of the Son of God. Those instructed in Christian science, now the he usually should compare always Jesus with the Christian scientists, with those who study Christian scientists. And that's very important, because if I have said he illustrated this big tone through the chronological history of Jesus' life, then I haven't said the whole, really. He illustrates that as an example which has been given to mankind, but he doesn't leave it at that. Always next to it, practically in every paragraph, next to it is all, he always says, and those instructing Christian science, the Christian scientists, the Christians, we all can do that too. She takes away, really, the sense that only Jesus could do it. She points out time and time, right after she shows it about Jesus, shows that we can do it too. That birth of the true man, the Christ man, is something which is not unique to Jesus, but is principled and therefore principally right for every one of us. And not only that it is principally right for every one of us, but that in principle we can't fight that to give birth to that man, and we must do it, and we are going to do it. We are going to do it. But how? And the how is always answered through the subtones. The subtones always give us the answer, but how can we do it? It's not enough to know that it can be done, or should be done, or must be done, or ought to be done. The question is, how?